An Osho Talk. Zen, The Path of Paradox, Volume 1, Number 10.
The first question. Eastern philosophy locates the essence of man in the atemporal observer. Western philosophy, since the rise of technology, locates the chief dignity of man in the ability to control the world, to act. In psychosynthesis, Asagoli marries East and West by positing both a passive witness and active willer. Do mixed marriages work? Yes, they work. They produce philosophical bastards. That's what goes on happening again and again. No marriage can be of any help. Unity is needed, not marriage. Marriage is a duality. The two remain the two. And the two continue to fight. Deep down, the conflict continues. It continues in all kinds of marriages. Because the question of domination persists. The husband wants to dominate, the wife wants to dominate. Subtle ways of nagging, subtle ways of possessing, but it continues. If you are trying to create a marriage-like arrangement between East and West, the same will be the result, the same will be the outcome. The East and West have to disappear. They are ugly worlds. The earth is one. There is no need for any marriage. The earth is round and one. It is nowhere divided. There is no line that divides East from West. It is all in the mind of man. It is all a kind of politics. The Eastern and the Western have lived too long and have created much mischief, have been very destructive. Many times it has been tried to create a kind of marriage. It cannot succeed. Because the marriage does not dissolve the duality. Rather, it accepts the duality and respects it. One has to see into the very division and its falsity. It is utterly false. It is untrue. Human consciousness is one. And that has to penetrate deep into our hearts. I am never for any marriage. There are people who try to create a kind of marriage between Hinduism and Islam and Christianity and Hinduism and this and that, East and West. It never succeeds. It only gives a false appearance that things are going okay. It is just appearance, it is not truth. Hidden behind it is much violence, conflict. And the old game persists in new names. You simply change the bottle. You never change the wine. By changing bottles, nothing matters, nothing happens. It is futile. Man has to be more mature now. And man has to see into things. If they are meaningless, they have to be dropped. Why marriage? Just drop the whole idea that anything divides humanity, religions, hemispheres, geographies, nations, all divisions have to disappear. Only then this world can be at peace. In the West also, there have been people who are as Eastern as any Eastern can ever be. For example, Mr. Eckhart, Jacob Bohme, Plotinus, Pythagoras, Heraclitus. These are as Eastern as any Buddha, any Nagarjuna, any Shankara, any Lao Tzu. And there have been Western minds in the East, as Western as any Western can be. A Charvaka is as Western as Bertrand Russell. It is not a question of East and West. All kinds of people exist in all kinds of places. The egoist has existed in the East as much as in the West. The idea to conquer, the idea to conquer nature, the idea to conquer God is as much Eastern as Western. And the idea to surrender utterly, is as much Western as much Eastern. Maybe at the most emphasis differs. That's all. Only emphasis. It is not very essential. Emphasis differs, and emphasis is very, very accidental. The moment you see that the essential is the same. Otherwise, how do you explain why Lao Tzu has so much appeal in the West? And why Karl Marx has so much appeal in the East? How do you explain it? Why Buddha is becoming more and more prominent in the West? Why Zen is becoming enormously significant in the West? And why technology is becoming so important in the East? The East is rushing towards West to know what technology is, how to become more and more technologically skillful. And the West is coming to the East to know what meditation is. Human inquiry is the same. And if there is any difference, it is only of emphasis. It has nothing to do with the East and it has nothing to do with the West. In the East, there are as many materialists as in the West. And in the West, there are as many spiritualists as in the East. Once you see this, then you don't try to create a synthesis. You simply see. There is no need for any synthesis. It is already one. It is exactly like the bisexuality of man. Each man is woman too, and each woman is man too. Emphasis is different. Maybe a man is 51% man and 49% woman. That's all. Or 55% man, or 60% man. But the 40% woman is there. And that difference is not constant and fixed. It changes. In the morning, maybe you are more woman. In the evening, you become more man. And sometimes when a woman is in rage, angry, she can become more of a violent man than any man can be. And when a man is in love and in compassion, he can become more loving than any woman can ever be. And there is a reason to it. Because when a man is loving, he is loving from his part which is not ordinarily used. And because it is not ordinarily used, it is very potential. It is like a fallow ground. For many years nobody has been harvesting any crop on it. It will yield more crop. When a woman becomes angry, she is more dangerous than any man can ever be. Naturally, because her man part has never been used. It is very sharp. It is brand new. It is exactly from the showroom. It is going to be very, very dangerous. But this has to be understood, that each man carries a woman within his heart, and each woman carries a man within his heart, within her heart. Then a unity is already there. And so is the case with East and West. And you change. You can watch this climate changing within you. Beggars come in the morning to beg, because they know people are more feminine in the morning. More possibility that they will give something. More possibility that they will say yes. By the evening people have become hard. They have suffered one day more. They have seen all kinds of cunningnesses and deceptions. And they have met all kinds of politicians and diplomats. And rugs, they become harsh. By the evening, no beggar comes. It will be impossible to persuade anybody to give you anything by the evening. Everybody becomes so hard by the evening that there is every danger he will rob the beggar himself. In the morning, you are more soft. The whole night's rest, the whole night with God, deep within your unconscious, you God dissolves. The whole night of a sincere existence, no deception, no repression. Whatever you wanted to do, you did in your dreams. There was no repression. You were not in any fight. There was nobody else. You were alone. And you were utterly free. That is the importance of dreaming. It gives you a taste of freedom. Otherwise you will go mad. The world makes you a slave. The dream again frees you. You can fly in the sky and you can go to the moon and you can do whatever you like. Nobody prevents you. Your freedom is utter. Your freedom is ultimate. No limitation exists. That's why the dreaming is so important. It keeps you sane. And if a man is not allowed to dream for 3 weeks, he will go insane. In the beginning, it used to be thought that it is sleep that keeps people sane. Now, it is no more so. Researchers say a man does not suffer much because of sleep, because of lack of sleep. He suffers much because of the lack of dreaming. Now many experiments have been done and it is now a proved scientific fact. You can be allowed to sleep. And if you are interrupted while you are dreaming, within 3 weeks you go mad. Even after 1 week, it becomes intolerable. Why dreaming helps so much? Why it keeps you cool? It gives you freedom. Freedom is an inner necessity. Hence, all those who have known the ultimate reality, they call it freedom, moksha, nirvana, absolute freedom. That is the urge, the desire, the great desire to become absolutely free. The reality does not allow you to be free. The dream gives you freedom. And in the morning, you are more at ease, more at peace, more together. Again, your compassion is back. Again, you are flowing. Again, your juice is flowing. Now, to say no will be difficult. To say yes is easier. In the morning, people are less egoistic than in the evening. In the morning, people are less violent, less ambitious than in the evening. In the morning, people are more religious. By the evening, they turn into politicians. Hence the morning prayer and its importance. When you open your eyes, the first thing is either meditation or prayer. Because this moment is very, very valuable. You will not get it again in the whole daytime. You will have to wait 24 hours again to get it. This is a great, significant, potent moment. Use it. Don't disturb it. Get into it. Get into this lucidity of being, into this grace that is flowing all around you. No, I am never for any synthesis. I am always for the pure unity before the division. Asaguli tries synthesis. Synthesis is always dead. You have accepted the division. You have accepted that East is East and West is West. Now you try to synthesize. You have accepted the very premise of the division. That is where Asaguli goes wrong. Don't accept the premise. Destroy the premise. And then see into reality. East is not East and West is not West. They are both, both. They are together. In each man, the West exists and the East exists. The East is the feminine part and the West is the male part. And the unity has not to be done in some philosophical way. The unity has to be done existentially within each man. When you are praying, you are Eastern. When you are meditating, you are Eastern. When you are fighting, you are Western. When you are competing, you are Western. Whenever the male part becomes assertive, you are in the West. And these are not geographical divisions. Wherever you are, if your male part remains dominant, then you are a Western man or a Western woman. Wherever you are, if your feminine part remains dominant, the softer. If you remain flowing like water and you are not hard like rock, then you are Eastern. And each man can be both. Yes, the water can also become frozen and can become rock-like. And the rocks can also melt. And to me, the synthesis has to happen in each individual, single individual. It has to happen in the heart. And the synthesis is not the right word for it. It is the discovery of the pure unity. Before you ever had thought that East and West, man and woman, yin and yang are separate, to fall into that chaos, in that unity where things were one. They are still one deep inside you. You don't go that depth. You don't touch that depth. That's true. You remain on the surface. All divisions are on the surface. If you go deep within yourself, first you will find, the first meeting will be, if you are a man, the first meeting will be with the man. The second unity with the woman. And the third meeting will be of something that transcends both. That is what is the real thing. The second question: what is the difference between philosophy, psychology and religion? Consciousness can go either out or in. These are the two ways available for consciousness. When consciousness goes out, it thinks about the object, the other, the Tao. When consciousness comes in, thinking disappears because there is no other, no object. It falls into subjectivity. When consciousness goes out, philosophy is created. Philosophy is thinking about objects. Philosophy is extroversion. When consciousness goes in, it forgets all about objects. It starts enjoying the being of subjectivity, of your interiority. You are simply there, enjoying the very fact of being alive, the very fact of being conscious. No object is there. You are pure subjectivity. No thought is there. You are pure consciousness. Extroversion is philosophy, introversion is psychology. And transcendence of both is religion. Buddha uses two words. For the outside, he uses dhatu, the object. Philosophy is concerned with the object. It forgets the observer. It remembers the observed. The arrow is pointed towards the without, dhatu, the object. And for the inner journey, Buddha uses the word citta, subjectivity. When you are moving inwards, psychology is created. When you are moving outwards, philosophy is created. And science is a growth of philosophy. But the modern psychology, the so-called psychology, is also not psychology in the sense Buddha uses the word psychology. Because the modern psychology again goes on thinking about minds. In an objective way, it uses the philosophical methods. Hence, it misses the point. That is the difference between the real psychology. Gurdjieff used to say that the real psychology has yet to born. What he means by real psychology? Sigmund Freud is not a real psychologist. Carl Gustav Jung is not a real psychologist. Adler is not a real psychologist. No. They all think in the objective way. Their psychologies are nothing but philosophies. They think about minds. The mind is taken as an object. They think about the mind from the outside. They watch. They observe. They analyze, they dissect. But the observer remains outside. The observer remains thinking. Gurdjieff says the real psychology is yet to born. In a sense, he is right. In a sense, not. If we think about Freud, Jung and Adler and company, then he is right. But if we think about Patanjali, Buddha, Lao Tzu, Hui Neng, then he is wrong. The real psychology has existed for a millennia. The real psychology has existed so long that we have forgotten about it. The new, the so-called psychology is very amateur. It is a very late arrival, just 100 years old. Very childish. The real psychology is the psychology of the Buddhas. The real psychology is to go inside your being, not to watch how rats behave, not to watch how others behave, not to go on looking outside, but to go inside with closed eyes, deep meditatively, alert, fully alert, watching what happens inside. Go on dropping from the outside into your inside, into your interiority. Go on forgetting the world of objects, then the world of thoughts, then the world of feelings. Go on dropping out, go on dropping out. A moment comes when your consciousness is there without any content. To know this consciousness is to know what real psychology is, the psychology of the Buddhas. And you ask, what is religion? The division between the out and in is still a division. So the in is also not very much in. It is part of the out. It is another aspect of the same coin. On one side is written out, on another side is written in. So philosophy and psychology are two aspects of the same coin. One is extroversion, another is introversion. What religion is? Religion is to throw the whole coin. To throw the coin itself. No more going out, no more going in, no more going at all. When going disappears, when the pilgrimage has ended, then you simply are, neither as an object nor as a subject. Then there is no knower and the known. Then there is no observer and the observed. Then there is oneness, an oceanic feeling of oneness. Then in the rose you are. Then in the trees you are. Then in the rocks you are. Then in people you are. You are everywhere. Then you permeate whole existence. This is religion. Philosophy going out, psychology going in, philosophy going not at all anywhere. All journeys dropped. Not getting identified with anything in or out. This transcendence is what religion is. In another way, if you ask Zen people, they have their way of saying it. They say, philosophy is that. Psychology is this. And religion is just suchness, tathata. That is an object. This is subjectivity. Thusness, suchness, tathata, existence, isness, kono mama or sono mama. Just isness. With no demarking line, with no label attached to it. With no identity. Just pure being. That is religion. So first move from that to this, then move from this to such. Tathata, is the ultimate word of Zen people. One who has attained to Tathagata is called Tathagata. That's why Tathagata is one of the names of Buddha. Who has attained to suchness. And when you are freed of this and that, you are freedom itself. Says Zen, in spring, hundreds of flowers. In autumn, a harvest moon. In summer, a refreshing breeze. In winter, snow will accompany you. If useless things do not hang in your mind, any season is good season to you. Then, in spring, hundreds of flowers. Suchness. You are those flowers. You are those birds singing. You are those stars shining. You are those rivers flowing. In spring, hundreds of flowers. In autumn, a harvest moon. And you are that moon. In summer, a refreshing breeze. And you are that breeze. In winter, snow will accompany you. You are that snow. And you will be accompanying yourself. If useless things do not hang in your mind, useless things, this and that, if they don't hang in your mind and you remain in suchness, any season is a good season to you. The method of philosophy is thinking, logic. The method of psychology is meditation, non-thinking, and religion has no methods. Sitting silently, doing nothing, and the grass grows by itself. The third question, is Zen against politics? Zen is so against politics that it never talks about it. It is so much against that it cannot be even against it. Because if you are against it, then it will affect you. Then somehow you will remain in some way related to it. To be against is to be related. Even when you are very much against, you are very, very related. It is a way of relationship. You are related to your enemy too. And sometimes even more than you are related to your friends. Zen is so much against politics that it does not say anything about it. But it is against any religion. Any religion worth calling a religion is bound to be against politics. Because the very phenomenon of religion is non-political. What politics is? Politics is ambition. Politics is ego. Politics is aggression. Politics is violence. Politics is an ego trip. How a religious person can be political? He can pretend that he is religious, but he cannot be religious. And how a political person can be religious? He can also pretend that he is religious, but he cannot be. These two things can't go together. Because to be religious, one has to drop ambition. And if you drop ambition, politics disappears. To be religious, one has to drop the ego. And when you drop the ego, politics is dropped. A religious person has to be without any ego whatsoever. So religion as such is anti-political or non-political. But the religions that you see around you, Hinduism, Mohammedanism, Christianity, Jainism, Buddhism, they are all political. They are no more religious. Whenever a religion becomes too much organized, whenever a religion becomes an establishment, whenever the religion has wasted interest in the society, in this particular society, in the status quo, then it is no more religion. A Buddha is religious. Buddhism is not religious. Jesus is religious. That's why he has been crucified by the politicians. But Christians are not religious. They are very, very political. A large meeting was attended by a small boy trying to sell 4 young puppy dogs. Finally, a man approached the boy and asked jokingly, "Are these political pups, Sonny?" "Yes, sir." "Well then," said the man, "I will take these 2. A week later, at the same place, there was a religious gathering, and the same boy showed up to sell the 2 remaining dogs. A man walked up to him and asked, "My little lad, what kind of puppies are these you have?" "They are religious pups, sir." The first man who had purchased the other 2 dogs happened to overhear this. "Say," he said, "did not you tell me that those pups that I bought from you last week were political pups?" "Yes, sir," said the young dog seller, "but these puppies aren't. They have got their eyes open." Politics is blind. It is a blind trip of the ego. One goes on groping to find some source of power, so that one can feel I am somebody. Politics is out of inferiority complex. Deep down you feel I am nobody. Deep down you are afraid of your nothingness. You cannot accept it. You have to deny it. Politics is a denial of your inner nothingness. Religion is rejoicing in it. Let me repeat it. Politics is an effort to deny your inner nothingness. Of course, you can never succeed in it, because that inner nothingness is your very nature. It cannot be denied. Your interpretation is wrong. That inner nothingness is nothing to do with inferiority complex. It is your interpretation that creates the inferiority complex. And out of the inferiority complex, you start trying to become superior, to become a prime minister or to become a president or something. This inner nothingness drives you somewhere. It may be money, it may be power, it may be prestige, it may be knowledge, or it may be even renunciation. But this inner nothingness drives you to find some way so that you can forget that you are nothing. You can start feeling you are somebody. You are something. Important, valuable, significant. Without you, the world will be at a loss. This inner nothingness is a driving force towards politics. But nobody can succeed to deny it. You can manage to postpone. Again and again it will assert. Again and again sitting on the throne it will be there. Again and again when you have arrived, you will know deep down. Whenever you will look inside, you will know you have not arrived. The inner nothingness is untouched by whatsoever you have done, by whatsoever you have accumulated, by whatsoever you have achieved. It remains untouched. That emptiness is still there. That's the misery of the successful man. Nothing fails like success. Failure is never such a failure as success is a failure. Because the failure person can still hope. In failure, hope still is there. You may succeed someday. But in success, all hope disappears. I have heard about President Coolidge, one of the great American presidents. When his term was over, he declined to stand again for the presidency. And there was every possibility that he would be chosen again. He was so much loved. He was such a silent man. So people started approaching him and asking, why? Why you are not standing again? It is almost certain you will be chosen. But he will say no. And he will say no with very deep, sad eyes. Finally, somebody forced him to answer exactly why he goes on saying no. And he said, because I have come to know there is nothing in it. And to repeat it second time will be stupid. I have come to know that nothing is gained by gaining such things. I remain the same person. How a chair can change you? You can sit on a golden chair, or you can sit on a very, very ordinary stool. It doesn't make any difference. You remain the same. How the chair can change you? How the change of the chair can change you? But this is the way the politician goes on befooling himself. No. A religious person cannot be political. A religious person, by its very religiousness, is non-political. He approaches life in a totally different way. What is the difference? What is the radical difference? The radical difference is that the religious man does not interpret his nothingness as inferiority. That is the revolution. The day it happens, you are fortunate, you are blessed. The day you start understanding that your inner nothingness is not inferiority, your nothingness is your very being. It is the way God is in you. God's way of being present is being absent. That's how God is present in the world. He is so non-violent that he remains absent. Deep inside you, the hole that you feel, the dark hole, is not dark. It is luminous with light. Enter into it. And it is not nothing. It is the very secret of the whole life, of whole existence. It is all. That nothingness is just the way God appears to those people who don't look deeply. It is a misunderstanding. The religious man befriends his nothingness. That's what meditation is all about. Befriending your nothingness. He enjoys it. He celebrates it. He dances it. He sings it. He goes again and again into it. Whenever he has chance, whenever he has opportunity, he closes his eyes. He drops into his nothingness. He disappears there. That is the very door of God. From there you connect yourself to the divine. Once you have started enjoying your nothingness, who bothers about politics? Nixon was out walking along the beach at San Clemente and decided to go for a swim. He got out beyond the waves and suddenly began drowning. Three teenage boys happened along, drove into the ocean, and pulled Nixon ashore. When he had regained his breath, Nixon thanked the boys. In appreciation, he said, "I will be willing to use my influence to help you boys in any way I could. Is there anything special you want?" "I would like to go to West Point," said one boy. "I believe I can arrange that," said the ex-president. "I would like to go to Annapolis," said another boy. "I will see to it immediately," said Nixon. "I would like to be buried in Arlington Cemetery," announced the third boy. "That's a very strange request," said Mr. Nixon. "Why would you want to be buried in Arlington Cemetery?" "Well," said the youngster, "my father is a religious man, and when I get home and tell my father who I saved from drowning, he is gonna kill me." Remember, this politician is always there till the ego is completely thrown away. It is always there. The ego is the politician. If you are egoistic, you are political. You may not stand in the election, and you may not strive for any political power, but if you have the ego, in subtle ways you will remain political. You may dominate your wife, your husband. You may dominate your children. You may dominate your servants. You will remain cunning. And you will never leave any opportunity if you can dominate. So when I use the word political, I don't just mean state affairs. No, I mean all affairs where domination is involved. If you want to have more money, you are political. Because if you want to have more money, you will have to exploit people. If you want to have more power, you will have to fight. If you want more prestige, you will have to be competitive. Your so-called saints are all political. They have their ambitions. Each saint wants to become the greatest saint. Then it is political. Then he will have to fight with other saints who are competitors. A religious person is non-competitive. And that's why I insist again and again. I am never tired of this insistence. Be meditative, because meditation is the only joy which is non-competitive. Only joy that you attain, but nobody loses because you attain. Nobody is a loser. If you have more money, somebody will have less money. If you have more power, somebody will have less power. If Morarji becomes the prime minister, Indira is no more a prime minister. Somebody loses. Somebody's gain is going to be somebody's loss. But a religious person will not like to do anything in which somebody becomes a loser. This is violent. This is ugly. This is inhuman. Then what is left for the religious person? He can celebrate his being. He can meditate. In meditation you gain and nobody loses. God is only infinite. Everything is finite. Money is finite. Power is finite. If you have, somebody will not have it. Only God is infinite. You can have as much as you like. You can have the whole of it, and yet nobody is a loser. That's the beauty of religion. It is non-violent joy. It is non-competitive joy. A panhandler stopped a congressman on a Washington street and asked him for a dime. "A dime won't buy anything these days," said the politician. "Don't you want a quarter?" "No," replied the panhandler. "With all these shady politicians around here, I am afraid to carry too much cash." And he is right. And this one from 20th century. Somewhere in 20th century, the anchorman on an educational TV late night news program surprised his viewers with this announcement: "We have good news and bad news for you. First, the bad news. Our planet is being invaded by Martians. And now for the good news. They eat politicians and pee gasoline." The fourth question. Ichazo reckons that our culture, the whole society, is now raising its consciousness that we are no longer on an individual trip, but that humanity is beginning to awaken. And he says that the utopian vision of humanity as one enormous family is now a practical necessity. This is how politics enters into religion. And this is nothing new. Down the ages, there have been people who have been saying it again and again. This is how fascism enters into religion. This is what Friedrich Nietzsche was saying. And he became the originator of Adolf Hitler and his philosophy. He was saying, now humanity has come to a point where we are going to enter into a new arena, the arena of superhumanity, superman. This is what Sri Aurobindo was saying in India. He was basically a politician, and he remained a politician to the very end. He was also saying, now we have come to a point where individual effort is no more needed. Collective effort. Remember that these ideas about collective effort are dangerous. That's how politics enters into religion. Religion is utterly individual and will remain individual. Only the individual can meditate. And when you meditate, you disappear from the collective world. If here you start meditating with 500 people, you may start with 500 people, but the moment you enter into meditation, you are alone. Those 499 are no more there. And so are they. Meditation is a movement in tremendous aloneness. It has nothing to do with the collective. You can meditate together, but when you go into meditation, you go alone. Three words will have to be understood: the collective, the individual, and the universal. And Ichazo goes on getting confused between the universal and the collective. The individual is in the middle. The collective is below the individual. And the universal is above the individual. If the individual becomes part of collectivity, he loses something. He is no more that much conscious as he was before. He is no more alert. That's why in a crowd, you are no more so responsible as you were when you were alone. A crowd can commit great sins. And in a crowd, you don't feel responsibility. The collective is lower than the individual. All great sins of history go to the collective. The individual is far better than the collective. You see a mob burning a Hindu temple or a Mohammedan mosque. You get each individual from the mob and inquires. And he will say, I did not really wanted to do it, but people were doing and I was just standing there, so I got into it. No individual Mohammedan will be able to say with clear heart that I have done a great thing, a great job, a religious thing by burning a Hindu temple. And no Hindu will say that I have done a great thing by killing a Mohammedan or by burning a mosque. But in the crowd he will say, I was lost. You may have also felt it. In the crowd you get lower than you ordinary are. In a crowd you fall baser, you become lower, you are more animal than you are human. The collective is animal, the individual is human, and the universal is divine. When a person enters into meditation, he does not become part of the collective. He becomes dissolved into the universal, which is a higher point than the individual itself. But politicians always talk about the collective. They are always interested in changing the society. And in changing the society, in making efforts to change the society and the structure of the society and this and that, they become powerful. The society has never been changed. It remains the same rotten thing. And it will remain the same, unless this is understood, that all consciousness happens into the individual. When it happens, the individual becomes universal. If it happens to too many individuals, then the society is changed, not as a social thing, not as collectivity. Let me explain it to you. You are 500 people here. You cannot be changed as a collective unit. There is no way. You cannot be made divine as a collective unit. There is no way. The souls are individual. Your consciousnesses are individual. But if out of these 500 people, 300 people become transformed, then the whole collective will have a new quality. But these 300 people will go through individual changes, through individual mutations. Then the collective will have a higher consciousness. Because these 300 people are pouring their consciousness into the collective. They are there. When one man becomes a Buddha, the whole existence becomes a little more awakened. Just by his presence. Even if he is a drop in the ocean, then too, the ocean, at least as far as one drop is concerned, is more alert, more aware. And that drop disappears into the ocean. It raises the quality of the ocean. Each individual being transformed changes the society. When many, many individuals are changed, the society changes. That is the only way to change it. Not the other way round. You cannot change the society. If you want to change the society directly, your effort is political. It also must be getting political. It happens. When you start becoming powerful religiously, when you start leading many people, when you become a leader, then great ideas start happening in the mind. Then the mind says, now the whole humanity can be changed. Now we should plan for a great change of whole humanity. Then greed grows, ambition grows, ego expands. This has happened always. And this will happen always. Beware of it. Never become a victim of the idea of the collective. The collective is lower than you. You have to become universal. The universal is not social. The universal is existential. You have to fall in tune with the whole existence. You have to get hooked with the dance of the universe, not with the social, not with small communities, sects, not with Christians and Hindus and Mohammedans, not with this earth, not with East, not with West, not with this century. You have to get hooked with the whole of it, the whole existence. But that is higher than the individual. The mass is a pitfall. The mob is always there to pull you down. And it happens to so-called religious people. Ichazo is not really very religious to me. He has gathered techniques from here and there. He is very eclectic. From Gurdjieff work, from Sufis, he has gathered few techniques. He is a technician. He knows the technology, but he does not know the goal. And he himself has not attained to it. But he is very, very technically expert, skillful. His movement, Arika, can turn into a fascist movement any day. And it creates a kind of fascism in its followers. There are few Arikans here, ex-Arikans, I should say. The ways of the Arikans are very political. Just few months before, Amida was very close to Ichazo for many years. She received a letter that you are expelled. Expulsion is basically political. How can you expel? What do you mean by expulsion? This is monopoly. She has come to me, she is expelled. Now my books, my tapes are not allowed there. No Arikan is allowed to read my books. This is political. What nonsense. This is monopoly, possessiveness. This is how politics comes into being. A religious mind is an open mind. You have to see. You have to listen to everybody. You have to learn from everybody. You should not be closed. Being with a really enlightened master, you become very, very open to existence. Utterly open. You will be open even to the devil if he comes to teach you something. You will be open and you will learn. And you will trust yourself that there is no fear because you know yourself. He cannot deceive you. These people who become so much afraid that somebody may get out of the fold, may get hooked with somebody else, are really basically doubting their own philosophy. They don't believe in their own philosophy. They know somewhere something may be better. Somewhere somebody may be higher. And then these people will go to him and they will leave me. Their fear is the fear of losing followers. So they create China walls around them. No, it never happens when there is a religious person. He gives you his love. He gives you his being. He gives you his wisdom and makes you free. And you can go on and you can go on learning. And each learning will prove you that your master is right. That is the trust. Wherever you go, even if you go to somebody who is against me and you listen to him, and if I was right, listening to him, I will prove right. It will not be a loss. You will come richer. Trust needs no fear. Love needs no fear. But it is not love. It is not trust. It is just fear. Now a fear is being created. If you go somewhere else, you will be expelled. And people are very afraid of things like expulsion. Is this a communist party or what? Expulsion? People are very much afraid of being expelled because people want to belong. They want to belong to some group because they don't have any soul of their own. Feeling in the group, they feel good. They belong to a certain community. The chosen few. The elite. The herald of a new world which is going to come. The leaders of the new world, the supermen. The first rays of the superman. And they feel very good. But that you can feel only when you are in the group. When you are alone, you become suspicious. And when you are in the group, you need not feel any responsibility. The group takes it from you. You are relaxed. The group takes care. And you have been brought up in dependence. First you were dependent on your parents. Then you became dependent on your own family, wife, husband. Then you became dependent on your own children. You have always lived a life of dependence. The society, the state, the church, the family, the community. You have lived a life of dependence. So when you go to a master, you want again somebody to depend to. Somebody to depend on. And a real master will not help you to depend on him. Because the real master will try to make you independent. His whole effort will be that you should be on your own feet. You should become your own being. That's what Zen people do. I was reading just the other day. A young man will come to Huineng again and again. And Huineng was very rough. Only Zen masters can be rough. Why? Because really they want you to be independent. They can be rough. He was very rough. He will slap the young man. He will close the door in his face. He will shout. And once he threw him out of the window and he fell deep down near about 15 feet into a ditch. And not only that, and then Huineng looked from the window and laughed. Certainly the man left him. This was last. Enough is enough. He left him immediately. He never came for 1 year. And he went to other masters. And he learned many things. And he roamed about. And one day, sitting silently in a cave, he became enlightened. The first Satori happened. And then you know what? He rushed back to Huineng to thank him. That day he knew, when the Satori happened, then he knew that exactly the same situation was created when he was thrown in the ditch. He missed. But now he knew, because now he again went to that point. He came to that situation inside. Just a moment before Satori happened, he was surprised to see that this is the same situation inside as Huineng had managed to create when he had thrown me and when he had looked down the window and he had laughed. I missed. That man has tremendous compassion. He came rushing towards him. He touched his feet and he said, "Master, thank you. Thank you that you were so rough with me. Thank you that you never taught me except beating me. Thank you for all that you have done for me." A real master wants the disciple to become a master in his own right. But ordinarily you don't want that independence yourself. You want somebody to cling to. You are a clinger. You want somebody to be very authoritative. Somebody to sit on a high throne and say to you, "You don't worry. I will take care of you. You forget all about. I am here, so I will take care of you. You simply come and follow me." But then, if somebody is there like that, remember, this is a sure sign. This authoritativeness, this taking other people's responsibility, is a sure sign that the man himself wants people to depend on him. He is dependent on his dependents. He enjoys it. He loves the idea that so many people are dependent on me. He himself is a dependent. Remember, he is not different from you. It is the same trap from the other end. If you leave him all, he will suffer as much as you will suffer. Sometimes he may suffer even more, because his investment was more. If you leave a man like Ichazo and all followers disappear, he may go mad. Or he may commit suicide. He will start very shaky. He will tremble. He will not know what has happened. He will lose all his self-confidence. He gains self-confidence when he looks into your eyes and sees that you are looking towards him. And you are feeling that he is right, he is true, he is the master. When he looks that look in your eyes, when he sees that reflection in your eyes, he feels confident. Yes, it is so. This is a mutual deception. My approach is absolutely non-political, hence absolutely individual. And that is the religious approach as such. Religion will remain individual. It will never become a collective phenomenon. It cannot become. Politics will always remain collective. It will never become individual. Politics is collective. Religion is individual. Spirituality is universal. Remember it. The fifth question, why can't there be only one religion in the world? Because people are mad. Because people are fast asleep. One religion can be. One day, maybe. We can hope for it. But one religion will not be like Christianity. Will not be like all have become Christians. No. One religion will not be like Hinduism that all have become converted Hindus. And one religion will not be like Judaism. No. When I say one religion, I mean there will be no religion like Christianity, Hinduism, Mohammedanism, Jainism, Buddhism. There will be a kind of diffused religiousness. That can be, and that should be. But remember, mind it, I mean by one religion, not one religion, not one organization, but a diffused religiousness. A religiousness without any label to it. without any particular church and particular dogma and particular Bible to it. Just a kind of religiousness, a kind of meditativeness, a kind of prayerfulness. Only that is possible. In the past, people have tried to create one religion. Christians have tried hard enough and killed millions of people. Mohammedans have tried very hard to create one religion. But that one religion was a kind of politics. Everybody should come under one fold. When I say one religion, I mean there should be no fold at all. Everybody should be free to do his own religion, to do his own thing. And people are different. So I will have my prayer in my own way. How there can be one prayer only? People are so different, their needs are so different. People are so unique. Somebody will be worshipping the tree and somebody will laugh at it. Somebody will think it is foolish nonsense worshipping a tree, and somebody will be a pagan and worshipping the tree and entering God through that green, through those flowers, through that foliage. To a man who is very aesthetic, a tree can be a great symbol of God. To a non-aesthetic man, to a mathematical man, it will be a sort of joke. What are you doing? To a mathematical mind, it may not look like very religious. And there are mathematical minds. But for them, mathematics is prayer. Albert Einstein is reported to have said that mathematics is prayer to me. And I have come to God through mathematics. Yes, there is a possibility. And he became by and by more and more religious. As death approached, he became more and more religious. Just before dying, he was almost a mystic. And he had never gone to any church. And he never believed in the Bible or the Quran or the Upanishads. His Quran, his Bible, his Upanishads were the universe, space, time, and the stars. And something that is beyond the stars. But entering into that mystery, going continuously into that mystery, he became a mystic. He started feeling the invisible, the intangible, the ineffable, was no more meaningful. The ineffable became more and more significant. The visible disappears and the invisible started appearing. He became a mystic. Somebody's mind can turn science into a religion. But to somebody, science will be just hard work. Mathematics will be trouble. Poetry may be his religion. People are different. So when I say one religion, I don't mean there will be one prayer and everybody will be doing the prayer in the same way and will be repeating the same words. No. When I say there is a possibility of one religion, I mean religiousness. Somebody will be praying before a statue, and somebody will be praying without a statue, and somebody will be praying before a tree, and somebody will be bowing down before a river, and somebody will be praying through service, and somebody will go to the mountains and disappear forever into the wilderness of it. But they all will be praying. And the quality of the prayer is the same. It does not matter whether you pray before a statue, or you pray before a tree, or you pray in an empty room. It does not matter, because it has nothing to do with the object. The object is just an excuse. And somebody will pray in Chinese, and somebody will pray in German, and somebody will pray in English. Language does not matter. And somebody may like Jesus' words to use for his prayer, and somebody else may like Muhammad's words. Everybody to his own liking. But there can be one religiousness. Right now, there are 300 religions on the earth. And these 300 religions, all these 300 religions are against the religion I am talking about. These are the real enemies. Obliged to remain in a certain town over Sunday, he started out to attend service in one of the churches of his own faith. But losing his way and seeing an open church door just across the street, he entered not knowing to what creed the congregation held. As the service progressed, his religious emotions waxed warmer until finally he gave vent to them by shouting out, "Praise God!" Immediately one of the ushers stabbed him on the shoulder and said, "You can't do that in this church, sir." He is simply saying, "Praise God!" But that may not be the way of that church. And the usher says, "You can't do that in this church, sir." You see the ridiculousness of it. Praising God cannot be done in a church. People are different. Somebody will have his prayer through dancing. And somebody may like just to sit silently doing nothing. All should be respected. In a one religious world, in a one religiousness, permeating whole humanity, all will be respected. And there is no problem. If you are reading Quran and you enjoy it, the real thing is to enjoy it. The real thing is to get in tune. And somebody gets the same high through the Bible, through Sermon on the Mount. So what is wrong? And somebody else, just by dancing and singing a song of Mira. So what is wrong? But these so-called 300 religions are basically political organizations against each other. A very Catholic woman returned from downtown New York, disheveled and distraught. "What happened to you?" asked a fellow Catholic woman. "I was in the garment district. At the same time, the Protestants were holding a rally. The mobs were thick and disorderly. Suddenly two thugs grabbed me and pulled me into an alley. They tore off my clothes and raped me. It was horrible." "Did not you scream?" asked the other. "Watch and have the Protestant think I was cheering for them." This is how things are. People are so against each other's religiousness. But that shows that they have not understood at all what religiousness is. Otherwise, how you can be against anybody else's religiousness? These are, again, ego patterns. People are different. About everything they are different. They are different about their love. They will be different about their prayer. They are different in their behavior. They are different in their communications. They are simply different. And this is good. The world is rich because people are different. The hood broke into the private party and with gun drawn, lined all the guests up along the wall. "Okay," he snarled, "now I am going to rob all the women and rape all the men." One of the women giggled. "You mean you are going to rape the women and rob the men?" she said. "Let him," a man in a lavender suit said. "Just let him do things his own way." People are different. This much has to be allowed. The world can have one religion, but not as an organization, not as a pattern, but only as a diffused climate of religiousness. The sixth question, I go on forgetting your words. What should I do? But who has told you to remember my words? That's how it should be. Exactly. Precisely. You have to forget my words. You have to remember the essence, not the words. And the essence need not be remembered, it has only to be understood. If you are listening to me rightly, you need not remember what I have said. In fact, if you try to remember it, you will miss the whole point. Then words will be there and the essence will be missing. You go on forgetting the words, otherwise you will be burdened by the words. And you will lose track. You just try to understand. And when I say try to understand, I mean just be silently, passively, alertly listening. Don't judge and don't argue and don't decide whether I am saying right or wrong. Just listen silently. Because if you become too much worried whether I am saying right or wrong, then you are not listening. And I am not saying believe what I am saying. No, just listen. And this is the beauty of pure listening. If you can listen purely, whatsoever is true will get into your heart and whatsoever is untrue will drop. There is no need to be worried about it. The heart knows. It is almost natural. It is like if you are being given blood, your blood will refuse if it is not of its own kind. A certain kind of blood will be needed. The same number of blood will be needed. If you have been operated and some skin has to be planted on it, anybody's skin won't do. Your body will reject. The body knows. Your own skin will have to be removed from other part, from some other part of the body. Then the body accepts it. And that's how it is. Truth is the food of heart. When the truth is heard, the heart simply accepts it. It is not a question of deciding whether it is true or not. This is the way of the mind. The mind is continuously worried whether it is true or not true. And because of this worry, the mind can never listen. Mind is deaf. It pretends to listen, but it never listens. You just put your mind aside. Let your heart listen to me. Let your heart be diffused with me. Let your heart be in tune with me. And if there is something true, it will get home. If it is not, you need not worry. It will disappear. And you need not be worried about my words. Be worried about me, not about my words. And I am not here propounding a philosophy. I am simply giving myself to you. There is a famous saying of Chuang Tzu, and he must have said this in answer to a certain questioner. Exactly like this. The fishing net is to get fish. Take the fish and forget the net. The snare is to get the rabbit. So take the rabbit and forget the snare. The seventh question, I am doing all the five meditations every day, regularly for 3 years. And because of these meditations, I cannot do anything else. I am feeling very happy, but my family is worried. What should I do? You are overdoing it, sir. You have to choose one meditation. One is enough. 5 is too much. Of course, you will feel happy because you have nothing else to do. And the family is naturally worried. And they are right too. A A big Yorkshire farmer found it necessary to go to London for several months and decided to leave one of his best workers in charge. "I want you to take care of things, Harry, as if I were here myself. Understand?" Harry nodded. 4 months later, the boss farmer returned to find everything in shape. Said Harry, pointing things out, "The chicks have been laying plenty of eggs. The wheat has grown double strong. The vegetables are better than they have ever been. And as far as those monthly spells your wife used to have, I have even got them stopped." This is doing too much. This is going too far. You please come to one meditation. It will be difficult, I know, after 3 years. You should have asked before. It will be difficult to go to the world and to work. And you may find it a little hard, but it has to be done. And I am not here teaching you any escapism. This is escapism. Now you are not doing anything else. Then you are dropping all your responsibilities, and I am not for that. Those responsibilities have to be fulfilled with great joy. Your wife, your children, your parents, your old father, your old mother, they need you. And that is the way God has put you into a certain responsibility. Fulfill it. I am against all those escapists who escape from the world and become 24-hour meditators. I am against them. I am utterly against them. 1 hour of meditation is enough. Meditation is such a powerful thing that 1 hour, 24 hours is enough. It will illuminate your whole life. And the test is in life whether your meditation is succeeding or not. When you meditate and you go to the shop, you will know whether you are succeeding in the meditation or not. Are you still greedy on the shop as you used to be before? Do you get still angry when somebody says something against you? Can people still manage to push your buttons as easily as before? In the marketplace is the test of all your meditations. Now if you do just meditations and do nothing else, that is preparing and preparing and never going to the examination. That's not right. The test has to be every day there. 1 hour meditation, 23 hours test. And you will grow strong. And the last question. What is Zen? Go on, beat it. That's exactly what the Pragya Paramita Sutra says too. Gate gate para gate, para sangate bodhi swaha. Go with all sentient beings. Go from delusion to enlightenment. Amen. Go on, beat it. That's what Zen is. It is not a philosophy to be understood. It is a transformation to be gone through. It is not something like information. It is not even reformation. It is total change. It is absolute radical change. It is a death and a resurrection. Die into Zen and be born into Zen. The word Zen means dhyana. It comes from the root dhyana. In China it became chan, and in Japan it became zen, but it comes from Buddha's word dhyana. Zen means dhyana. Zen means meditation. Enough for today.